Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
A couple things before I start. She just said that I've lived in a homeless shelter for the last year. That's true. We moved out about 2.5 weeks ago. So it's still very fresh and raw. So you're going to hear a wide mixture of objectivity and subjectivity with this.
What else do I want to say before I get started here? I've been asked to kind of tell this story 3 times this week to a service group of students at my university. So I'm going to try to make the shift more towards an academic talk, but if I slip back into, like I'm talking to a bunch of 18-year-olds, forgive me. Or maybe that's what you want me to do. I don't know. So the model that we're going to be talking about today, I debated on whether to put this on here or not. The agency that I'm going to be speaking specifically about, it's called Abilene Hope Haven. It's a nonprofit in Abilene, Texas. Abilene, Texas is kind of out in the middle of nowhere in West Texas, about 3 hours from Dallas. We are a very churched community. We have a disproportionately high number of churches. We also have an incredibly disproportionately high number of people experiencing homelessness in our community. Not sure why those two things exist. Actually, I have some ideas why those two things exist, but that's another workshop. So what I want to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about our story, kind of tell you how we got to what we're doing, why we're doing what we're doing, and then hopefully it will generate some questions and we can have some good discussion at the end of this. Probably at some point you'll wonder why, what kind of social worker I am to make some of the choices that we've made over the last year. We'll have some good talks about ethics and boundaries, perhaps, talks that I've continually had to have with myself. So I'd love to hear some sharing of some experiences and things like that, especially if you have a history working with people experiencing homelessness. I do not. My area of practice before I came to ACU is in school social work. I did a lot of behavior modification, worked with kids in special ed, that sort of thing. And then I just kind of happened into working with people experiencing homelessness. It was when I first came to ACU back in 2009. A lady from our kinesiology department, she emailed me. I didn't know her. And she said, "Hey, I'm on the board of this homeless shelter in Abilene or in town. Would you like to come join the board of directors?" She didn't know anything about me. I was looking to get involved in the community, kind of check that service part off on tenure and promotion. And so I said, "Yeah, let's do it." So I am, like a lot of social work faculty, socially awkward. I'm an introvert. And so for the first couple of years of this board that I was on this board, I never really said anything. Literally, the only thing I would say in board meetings is voting aye. Never voted nay, because, I don't like confrontation. So I would vote, and I was by far the youngest member of this board of directors. I was probably 20 years younger than the next person to my age. But funny enough, over the 8 years I've been on the board, those people started to kind of fall off the board. They retired, and so I would recruit board members, sometimes my friends, sometimes people I would go to church to, sometimes people I work with, until I kind of look around a couple of years ago, and I am the longest tenured board member. And the board is much younger at this point. I probably fall in the median age of the board right now. Mostly people in their 20s, we have a few people in their 20s, some 30s, and then 40s, a couple people in their 50s. So it's been a dramatic shift in the way that the board, or in the dynamic of the board, the makeup of the board of directors goes. A lot has happened over the last 6 years. For a while on the board, I would shut up in the board meetings, just kind of vote. Things were just business as usual. We had a good board, a good executive director for this agency. We were in great financial shape, which is odd for a nonprofit in general. Never really any financial crisis. We were funded by HUD. And so what we did was, and I'll jump into this, our old model. We're a transitional housing facility. I will say first and foremost, I acknowledge sheltering is not the best way to end homelessness. I know that. I know that shelters are by far not our first place that we would want to put people looking for permanent housing. So with that caveat, So we're a transitional housing facility. You know, for a long time, transitional housing in the United States has kind of been the gold standard on how to shelter people that were homeless. Now, if you don't know a lot about transitional housing, there's a lot of barriers there. It's very restrictive. And we were no different. I never really questioned our rules. I just said, you know, this is the way things have been going. That's great. We have a 21-bed facility. We can actually house more people than that, but our insurance company said 21 is the most you can have if you only have one person on staff 24 hours a day. And so basically what it was is if you were verifiably homeless, we would house you. You had to come in. You had to be clean and sober for 30 days. You had to pass a drug and alcohol test. As you might assume, that would disqualify a majority of the people that would come through looking for housing. Again, I didn't question that. It's just the way we did it. We would do a criminal background check. We didn't exclude everybody with a criminal background. We were looking for violent offenses, high-level drug offenses, sexual offenses, those sorts of things. If by some miracle you could pass those two things, we would let you out, TB test, all that sort of stuff. We would let you in. We only took people that were single or families with kids that were 10 and under. If you had a child between the ages of 10 and 18, you were not qualified. For whatever reason, they just didn't want to assume the liability of that stage of adolescence. So anyway, once you got to the facility, it was still pretty restrictive. With transitional housing, there are work requirements. You had to have a full-time job or be enrolled full-time in school within 30 days of entering the program. If not, you were evicted. You had to save 30% of your income. And then we get into the fun rules. You had to turn in your phone when you got in. You had to put it in a box when you walked in the door. I didn't know some of these rules along the way. But you turned your phone in. The kitchen closed at 6:30 p.m. Laundry room closed at 8 p.m. If you worked late, you were given 15 minutes to make yourself a sandwich and get to your room. You had a 10:30 curfew, it means in your room. Those sorts of things. Saying them out loud is horrific to me, saying that I was on the board of directors that had this many restrictions for this population. But hey, you know, we were helping the homeless in Abilene. And that's just the way a lot of transitional housing facilities would actually function. Let me think, what else am I missing here? So that's the way we did things. Now, we had a 21-bed facility. Rarely, if ever, were we full. I think one time we were down to 6 people. Occasionally, we'd get up into the high teens, but rarely we were ever full. You could stay there for up to a year. The average length of stay was 4 months, and those were people leaving of their own volition. You know, tax return gets in, they leave. Or just leaving just for whatever reason. We didn't really keep track of where they were going. So like I said, I was on this board of directors for a while. A couple years ago, I found myself as chair of the board of directors. So my big accomplishment, what I was pretty proud of myself for, was helping organize the biggest fundraiser we had ever done. We didn't raise that much, but we hadn't ever done that great of fundraising. And so I was pretty happy. We did that in April. I'm like, all right, I'm going to ride out the rest of my time as board chair, sitting pretty, not really doing anything, finding a couple more of my friends to grow the board a little bit. You know, trying to do what I thought we needed to do. So October came 2 years ago, and our executive director, who I said was not a social worker, she was a fundraiser, and a very good one. She called me and she goes, "Hey, I need to talk to you. I'm going to come to your office at school." And I knew she's either coming to my office because she needs a check signed, or that's the only reason she actually ever come to my office. So I didn't figure it was probably good news. But she came in and she walks in. She goes, "Okay, I quit." Not bad. She goes, 2 weeks notice. She goes, "I've gotten an offer for my dream job, so I'm leaving. You have 2 weeks." And so my little sitting pretty on the board was over. I had to now chair an executive director search, which I had no idea how to do. So we kind of called an emergency board meeting, and we put out the call for directors. And within 2 or 3 hours, we got our first application. It was from a guy that I knew. I went to college with him. I didn't know him very well. I knew he had a degree in social work, but had never practiced social work. He is a youth minister for most of his career. Spent a couple years in China doing missions. And so not qualified, really, for the job. Another guy on the board actually knew him because they had attended church together in Dallas at some point. And so we decided to interview this guy just because we both knew him and we both knew he had a good heart. Sorry, I'm a little bit sick. I'm trying not to choke here. So we interviewed this guy. His name was John. Came in for the interview. Told us some things that I had no idea. I knew him a little bit, but I didn't know that he was homeless when he was a teenager. Mom was in an abusive relationship. Both parents were addicts. This is a story he has told in public. I have permission to tell it. His mom left his father at one point, and they ended up living in their car for a while. He ended up living with his grandma the year before he came to college. She's the one that he accredits to, you know, introducing him to God, introducing him to the church, all those sorts of things. And so he's always had this place in his heart for people experiencing homelessness. He said, and you know what, I like being a youth minister. He goes, but at some point I have to stop telling all the kids in my youth group we have to help the homeless. He goes, and I have to actually go help the homeless. He had a brother who is currently living on the street in a town about 2 hours from us. He told his wife, he said, I got to go get him. I can't tell people to help the homeless when my brother is homeless. Drove, found his brother after a couple days, loaded him up, moved him in. His brother is now a physician's assistant, so there's good coming out of that. But anyway, and so after his interview, one of the board members said, I mean, can we make an offer now? You know, like I said, he was not qualified. But we knew that there was something there that we needed. One of the things that he was saying that I liked as a social worker, that I liked that he was saying is housing first. He kept talking about housing first. I love housing first. We're not housing first. We are quite the opposite of that. We're like housing third. You know, sober, criminal background, then we'll house you, okay? Housing third, not nearly as popular as housing first. Actually, sadly, it is as popular as housing first. But anyway, and so he kept talking about housing first, about that's the model that he wanted. So we knew if we hired him, we were going to have a significant transition going from a very restrictive type shelter to a housing first model. Shelters are very difficult to make housing first, but we're at least going to go theoretically. We did not have the 2 years that we had planned to make that transition. 2 weeks after he came in, HUD decided no more transitional housing. We're only going to fund housing first, and we want our $270,000 back. Well, we're just not going to renew that grant. And it was crippling. Now, we had a good savings account. That was the only thing that kept us from just, you know, padlocking the doors and calling it all in. So we had this new director who had moved his family a pretty good distance to us. And 2 weeks in, we're like, we can't fire him. We have to figure this out. So we, you know, I was chair of the board, and we would, you know, pray about it and all that sort of stuff. And finally, we had a board meeting, and he said, and we had reapplied for housing dollars for a rapid rehousing program. But rapid rehousing does not utilize a shelter. And so we had this shelter paid for about 12,000 square feet in, you know, fairly good shape as nonprofits go. You know, but and it's kind of like a dorm. It's a long hall with all these different individualized rooms, community kitchen, community living area, laundry room, things like that. So we said we could sell it. We didn't feel like that was really that great. And so John, our director, said, well, I have a crazy idea. Why don't we dip into our savings? Why don't we start really fundraising? And why don't we try to reopen this shelter? And all we're going to do is we're going to make up the rules to the shelter based on what we believe is best practice. We're not going to have to play by HUD's rules. We're not going to have to do all this other stuff. Let's look at trauma-informed care. Let's look at housing first. Let's try to open a shelter like we had never seen before. And so we're like, all right, that sounds great. So we start looking at this. We rewrote all the policies and procedures. And then the last thing he wanted to do is he said, I want to have staff living in the shelter. He said, I don't want hourly staff. We had had kind of basically what we'd had was minimum wage staff that would sit there, you know, not anyone trained in working with people experiencing homelessness, just that type of employee. And so what we were finding out is there was a lot of power dynamics going on there. The people that we would hire kind of run it as a prison. And so he said, I don't want that anymore. I want to find somebody to move in and live in community with these people that are experiencing homelessness. He kept using the words radical hospitality and intentional community and those sorts of things. So I'm like, all right, not sure where we're going to find that person, but all my support. And so we, sure enough, we had trouble finding that person. You see where this is going. Side story, my wife and I had just bought some land outside of town. We were going to build our dream home, but we needed to save up for a little bit first. So we had sold our house. We actually closed on it last year while I was at NACSW, so this is about a year ago. And so we sold our house, and we had this rent house that we were going to move into. A guy that I work with was flipping a house for himself, and he was going to let us move into this house, open-ended lease, bring our idiot dog, those sorts of things. And so he was very, you know, he was doing us a big favor by holding this house for us. And so I don't remember exactly what happened. I was cleaning house with my wife one morning. And I laughed to her. I said, well, let's just move into Hope Haven. And, you know, we both kind of laughed. And then she comes back to me in 10 to 15 minutes. My wife also has a bachelor's in social work. So she comes up to me and she goes, were you serious? And I said, no, I wasn't. She goes, well, let's talk about what that would look like. So I'm like, I don't think it would look like anything. I think it would look like a disaster. So I have four kids. I have, at that time, they were 10, 8, and then I have a couple of two-year-olds. And then a dog that's bigger than all of them. And so we talked about it, and I'm like, all right, well, let's just go and talk to John about this idea. As soon as I called John, he was all in. He's like, yes, of course it should be you. He goes, you're kind of the co-architect of this thing. You know what our vision is. Of course it should be you. So we go up and we look. Now, I've been in this shelter so many times, but I've never looked at it as a potential home. And so we go in and we look. And we're like, all right, I guess we could take up this space. I guess it might work. It would be a logistical nightmare. It would be we'd be moving down into a little over 700 square feet, you know, for our family. And so we're talking. I mean, our house is already boxed up at this point. We're just waiting to start moving into this rent house. And so, and I will say, shame on me. I am usually very skeptical of people that tell stories like this. But this is exactly how it happened. Please believe me. And so we're in the kitchen of this facility, and I'm like, let's just pray about it, okay? And so I said a prayer that I thought would definitely disqualify me from this service. I said, all right, God. I said, I want to know today, and I want to know loud and clear if this is what we're supposed to do. And I thought, you know, that's not going to happen. I promise you, during the prayer, I get an email on my phone. I'm checking it, and it's the guy whose house we were going to rent. And he says, something has happened. I'm staying in this house. I don't have any place for you to move. And I'm like, well, guess we're moving into a homeless shelter. And so I kind of took that loud and clear, and people ask why we did it. And I'm going to be completely honest. I'm going to be very transparent with a lot of this today. We did it. There was a lot of fear involved that I did it for, because I'm like, if you ask God to tell you whether you should do something and he unequivocally says yes, I was very afraid of what would happen if I didn't do it. So, you know, self-preservation. So we moved in. We moved in almost exactly a year ago today. So there's my idiot dog. This is standing outside of our new home right after we moved in. So let me tell you a little bit about this new model that we started adopting. The first thing that my wife and I did when we got in is we realized this does not feel like a place we want to live. I describe it as a dirty hospital. You can see the grocery store tile floors. People have lived in this facility 24 hours a day, 365 days a year since 2000. So no one has really ever come in and done a deep clean of this place. So it was dirty. The colors were no good of the walls. There was red, there was some purple, there was some green, there was a horrible mural up. Things that are great if it's not your house. You know, there was signs everywhere. No cell phone use in the hall. Laundry room closes at 10 or 8. Kitchen closes at 6:30 p.m. I'm like, we don't even start cooking dinner till 7. So those sorts of things that we're revisiting on how to, what we wanted to change. So we really went through and started ripping all the signs down. We started painting. We enlisted the help of our wonderful Bible class at church. I'm not going to get too much into how I believe the church has failed homeless people. However, people are generally good, I believe, and they want to know how they can really help. We are lucky. We have a very well-resourced people that we go to church with, rich. And so they just were willing to throw money at some things. Which I don't know if that's a healthy outlook, but I'm not telling them no. So we registered for gifts at like Target and Hobby Lobby and things just to put some art on the wall, put some rugs on the floor. If they're very basic things about trauma-informed care, about less fluorescent lighting, more dimmable lighting, more things that make it look like a home. So we went through all the rooms and just kind of did a complete overhaul on a very limited budget to try to make this place feel a little bit more warm and like home. Policies and procedures completely changed. There was no curfew. We don't do drug and alcohol screenings. We did have a rule that there was no drugs or alcohol on the premises. We have found them. We have not kicked anybody out because of that. We are not looking to kick people out first and ask questions later. We are looking to be very open and try to help people. And so this model was actually to go hand in hand with our new rapid rehousing program. So if you don't know much about rapid rehousing, basically it is if you're verifiably homeless, we're going to try to get you into your own rental unit within 30 days. But what do you do during that 30 days? This is where we wanted to put people. We've had people there for 7 months. Some more permanent supportive type housing people. We don't have any permanent supportive housing options in Abilene. We didn't have any rapid rehousing options in Abilene. We really don't have any housing options in Abilene very much, besides Salvation Army. And so anything is better than nothing. So we looked at our policies and procedures. I took the curfews away, took all work restrictions away, basically tried to make it look as close to housing first as we could. No age restrictions if you have kids. We don't have any definitions of family. Before, you had to be legally married to come in. And by the way, you weren't allowed to have sex with your spouse while you were at the facility in the year that you lived there. Took that out. We allowed people to identify as families however they saw fit. So if you came in with three people that you are not related to and wanted to identify as a family and live together, that's great. Let's do an assessment and see if we can house you. So we use the VI SPDAT, which is horrible to say, the Vulnerability Index Service Provider Assessment Tool. I think I said that right. But basically, we're looking at to admit people, we are looking at the people that are of the highest need. So it's not a true waiting list. If you come in and you score off the charts on that rating scale, you're going to be the first to move in and you're going to jump everybody else on the waiting list. And those people typically are the people with substance abuse issues, with mental health issues, people with children, people fleeing domestic violence, those sorts of things. And so we kind of relooked at the whole model. We reopened about a year ago, welcoming in our first family. And so trauma-informed care. I will say, this PowerPoint, so basic. I was set down to make one, and I had a student that made this one last year. I said, you know, this is just good enough. Let's just use this one. It's a bunch of pictures. It's great. But basically, trauma-informed care. We kind of have a debate on our faculty on whether trauma-informed care is evidence-based and whether we should use it or not. I don't know why I said that, but we do realize that there is some debate out there on trauma-informed care, but we do believe that we should at least try, acknowledge that trauma-informed care is something that is beneficial. And so, like I said, we looked at something specifically called the sanctuary model. The sanctuary model is something that's big on mental health treatment in residential care. But basically, it is people that move in have the right to kind of self-determine what type of community they want to live in. Self-governed, by and large. Not a prison type approach. It's basically, we're going to let you function as a community and we're just here to help build that community. That was what we moved in for. Sure, we had some policies and procedures, but basically it just was, don't do anything illegal. Things that would get you kicked out of a rental unit outside of here, that's what's going to get you asked to leave here. And I will say, in the year that we've run this, we've only asked one person to leave. And it's because she kept inviting her abuser that she had fled into the facility overnight, and he got aggressive with one of our staff, my wife. And so we moved her out actually into her own rental unit. We also made the decision that we would never, ever move anybody out onto the street. Everybody we move out, we're going to move into some sort of housing. And so we tried to do a trauma-informed approach called the sanctuary model. So we were going to let it be as self-governed as possible. That's been marginally successful, but it's a work in progress. So what does this look like in an emergency shelter? It still doesn't really look like a home, but if you can picture this hall, so this is where I lived, right here. If you can picture this hall, it was royal blue walls all the way down. Just added a few things like lamps, like artwork on the wall. Every time a kid comes in, they get to do a painting on a canvas. We'll frame it, we'll hang it. And then, you know, doormats, silly things like that. Things that I know aren't going to end homelessness, just little bitty things that hopefully will make a cumulative difference in somebody's life. Focusing on the community areas. We really wanted to look at community-based living. From what I know about community-based living, about cultures that really thrive on community, it's they have better outcomes in general. They have better health outcomes. They better have better income outcomes, those sorts of things. So we really wanted to try to build this community. Who do we serve? We serve people that are verifiably homeless. We serve people who are living in places that are not meant for human habitation. So if you are living with a relative, chances are you're not going to qualify for our program. If you are living in your car, you will qualify for our program. And I said a minute ago that Hope Haven before was never full. Right now, we have a waiting list of 375 individuals or families. Those are people in Abilene, a town of 150,000 people. Those are people in Abilene that are verified homeless. Those are people who score high enough on the vulnerability index to qualify for housing. So that's what we do. So let me just talk a little bit about this community-based living idea. So what we really wanted to do was try to encourage community as much as possible, but not force it. If you've been on the street for 2 years and you want to come and sleep for 6 days in your room, take a box of Lucky Charms in there and don't ever come out for meals. Somebody did that. That's your business. We respect that. We respect that you're an adult. And if you want to self-determine in that way, that's what we're going to respect. But basically, what our idea was that we would have these occasional community meals, that we would have silly things like Super Bowl parties and just, you know, life skills lessons. That was another thing, is in the old model, every night there was a life skill lesson. We did Dave Ramsey. You know, here's how to save all this money you don't have. But basically, I'm being cynical. But you're required to come. So after you get off of your minimum wage job that you've worked for 10 hours and wrestled with your kids over dinner, now you have to come sit and listen to a certified public accountant tell you about your taxes. You know, so we decided that probably wasn't the best model. We would offer some life skills classes, but they were going to be strictly optional. I did the very first one. It was basically just on how to use Google Docs. One person came and we spent an hour and a half building her resume. It had nothing to do with Google Docs, but that's basically what our life skills classes kind of turned into. But one of the things that surprised us, this is a group that already has community. They have community like I don't. When I would talk to students, I would say that's one of the biggest shocks is when you have a community of survival, when you're on the street together, when you are at Salvation Army together, you have a community like I don't have in my house where you drive and park in the back and you don't ever have to see your neighbors if you don't want to. That sort of thing. That is one thing that I think I am doing wrong in life. But our first night there, we had this couple that he was an ex-gang member, about 6'7", covered in tattoos. She had a horrific story, as most of them did, about their life. But the very first night, they're like, can we cook for everybody? I said, yeah. So they went in and they fried pork chops. Another thing that I learned, so before I moved in, I was a pretty hardcore vegan, vegetarian. Really cared about food, really cared about non-GMO, organics, that sort of thing. 25 pounds later, a year later, I realized that when somebody fries pork chops for your family and your family alone, you eat them. And that's not something really that they taught me in micro practice in college. But that's one thing that we found is they love to live in community with each other. They love to cook for one another. The first 3 weeks that we were there, five nights out of the week, they wanted to do community meals. That took a big hit to our budget because we kept having to shop. But we started getting really good at begging on Facebook for church groups to start dropping off groceries. So it taught me a new type of fundraising. But these individuals, they said to us, they said, you know, we all knew each other from Salvation Army, but we didn't really know each other until we were given the opportunity to actually just sit and be. And so I think that's one of the things that our director really had good vision for, is letting people live the lives that they want to live where they are right now. Of course, none of these people want to be here for the long term. But I think there's a lot of thinking out there that says you need to make the shelter as bad as possible while still housing them so they'll want to get out faster. There's a lot of that thinking in, like, we had a lot of talks with the Texas Homeless Network, and they said, no, you're being too nice. You don't need a TV in here. You shouldn't allow people to just sit in the common rooms. I do understand that a little bit. But there's also something about working with people who've had their dignity stripped away every day, who are used to being told what to do, saying, I'm not going to tell you what to do because you're older than me. You know more about poverty and being homeless than I ever do. You cook better than I do. I need to let you live the life that you know how to live and just be here to support you in your mission to be housed. It is still very housing focused. We have two very housing focused case managers that do regular visits, very structured service plans to talk about how to get them into their own home. Some of the changes that we've made, we started by charging them rent, very little rent. I think it was $5 a week. There are several reasons we stopped doing that. The main reason being is when you're looking for them to qualify for public housing, they weren't qualified as homeless anymore. They're saying, well, they're in a housing, they're paying rent, so no more rent. We used to make them pay security deposits. We just wanted them to have some sort of ownership in it. We weren't finding that that was helpful, and we weren't ever getting security deposits. And so we stopped doing that. We didn't want reasons to be contentious with them. Other things, you know, just trying to look to make this as much like a home as possible in a group living situation. I could keep going and telling lots of stories, but basically they eat together all the time. One of the best things that I think that we did is my wife and I, before we moved out, we decided we wanted to take them to a nice steak dinner. So we asked our friends, said, you know, we want to do this. If you could donate, you know, we need about $800 for this. And so we got it pretty quick from our friends. And we took them out to a steak place in town. Well, the first thing that they said is, they said, all right, we're all going to go to a steak dinner. And someone said, ooh, are you going to take us to Golden Corral? I don't know how many people go to Golden Corral's fine, I'm sure. We're going to take you to a real steak dinner. And I remember we went, and there was a girl there. She was 22, fresh off of a ravaging meth habit, trying to get her kiddo back from Children's Protective Service. We got her, they were living in a tent at the state park, trying to come down off meth. She had been adopted by three families growing up. All three had returned her. I remember we sat down and she looked and she goes, now we're not allowed to order like off of the steak page, right? And we're like, yeah, you can, there's nothing on this menu you cannot have. And she's like, no, this is a $40 steak. I can't order this. And so my wife took one for the team and ordered lobster and steak, like the most expensive thing on the menu, just to set the precedent. I know, my wife's a servant like that. Order lobster and steak. But just looking to do things a little bit out of the ordinary. Now I'm telling you the highlight reels. I will also tell you the last year was the hardest year of my life. I am a emotional, broken mess of a man after leaving there. We're kind of picking up the pieces to ourselves after that. But it was also the most blessed year I've ever had in my life. I was able to see, I'm not used to talking like this at academic conferences. I was able to see God through people that are broken, through people that are at the worst point in their life, unlike I've ever seen him in other situations. I also was blessed tremendously more by the situation than I think we ever blessed anybody that was there. We learned community. We learned survival. We learned about relationships through this group of people. And this is where I could get in trouble as a social worker. I would count some of these people as friends. When you share a wall with your clients, it takes on a completely different meaning. We made the decision really early on as an organization that we're not going to use the word client. We're only going to use the word neighbor. Literally, they were my neighbors, so that was accurate. But to see the influence that they were able to have on my kids and that sort of thing, that was something that was truly transformational for us. So we moved out. What's my next slide say? Let me make sure. Okay, we can get going through the rest of the stuff. So the outcomes, what we were hoping. First thing, I'm going back a little bit. When we were deciding what kind of shelter to open, we started with our outcomes. What do we want our goals to be? John, our director, his big thing is hope. As a social worker who loves quantitative, that's a hard thing for me to wrap my brain around. But he said, he changed our mission statement when he came to, we want to inspire hope in the lives of our neighbors experiencing homelessness. We'd like to end homelessness. Yeah, we'd like to do housing. But at least if we could provide hope, that's what he said. And so we start thinking of what hope looks like. So our outcomes, we want you to be housed. We want you to be housed within 90 days. That was our goal. Right now, we're running at about 110 days to housing. But we have been able to house about 70 of our neighbors that have come through. Some of them have fallen out of housing, and we have tried to rehouse. Really, right now, the reason we're not able to house people sooner is we just don't have enough realtors or property owners in Abilene that are willing to work with us. We have one church that has several properties that they were just using for whatever. Well, they've cleared those out. They're letting us rent those. And we have a couple of apartment complexes that are renting to us. But we've been able to house about 70 people. We want sustained income. And so we're working, while job placement is not a requirement, we are working to place people in jobs. We actually have a lot of people that went back to college or went back to get their GED this year. We have a very good relationship with the Workforce Commission. We actually employ two people from the workforce at Hope Haven. One is our administrative assistant, one is our janitor. But we're able to put people in there. So we have several people studying to be welders. And so those are the things we want. We're looking at sustainability. We're looking at actually helping people stay housed permanently. We also got funding that we just started collecting data for a five-year longitudinal outcome study, which United Way, as part of our funders, loves. They like outcomes. And so I'll just go over this real fast. So the vulnerability index, the VI spit out, which I was talking about, it ranks you on a scale from 0 to 21, with 21 being catastrophically vulnerable. We have never seen anyone over 18, and we have seen some pretty catastrophic cases. I don't know what it would take to be 21. I think probably it would take somebody who has a lot of substance abuse issues, sex offender, veteran, battered woman with 8 kids. That's probably what a 21 would look like. But the average that we've seen is a 6.23, and this is of the 74 people that we've done intakes for so far to come in. Usually to be housed, you'd fall somewhere between we've housed someone as low as a 4, and we've gone, like I said, as high as an 18. Income, right now, by and large, it's 0. The main source of income that we're looking for or that we have for these people, some people are getting veterans benefits, some people are getting SSI, some people are getting some form of disability, that sort of stuff. Housing. This is what we're looking at as long-term. And so what we're looking to do over the next 5 years, I should have started with that, is we're assessing them at 30, 60, 90 days in the shelter. And then once they get out into housing, we're assessing them at 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 years down the road. So hopefully we're going to be still collecting data about 4 or 5 years from now. But we want to look at the housing situation to make sure that they've stayed housed. And then I did find a measure of hope. We're using the HOPE Index, basically the way that they define hope, and it's quantitative, so we all win. I win. We're looking at hope. It's from 0 to 400, with 400 indicating higher levels of hope. Basically, the way that it defines hope is, does your expectation of your life meet your reality of your life? And we have a lot of people who are very hopeful, it would seem. But the average on there is about 126. The average when they normed it over about 1,000 people throughout the United States, the U.S. average was about 210. So this group is fairly, significantly lower on hope. And then satisfaction with life survey. That's I think it goes from 0 to 32, with 32 indicating you're more satisfied with your life. Right now, we're at a 16. So over the next few years, both in the shelter, we're going to be looking at people who came through the shelter and people who just went straight into housing. I don't know what I hope to see. I would like to see that the people that we've sheltered in this type of program have higher levels of this, but I would also like to see us be able to house people sooner and be able to skip the shelter altogether. I think that not going into the shelter is better for you. But that's basically what we've done. Definite challenges. We knew it would be hard doing this. And I'm not talking, I don't want to talk just specifically about my family and my experience, but I'm going to for a minute. Ethical challenges for sure. We've recently purchased a house and we moved into it. One of the girl that was 22 that I was talking about, who's studying to become a welder, she texted us the other day, And, you know, we didn't tell a lot of people we were moving out to a house, but some people asked, you know, where are you moving to? Well, we're moving to a house. Well, she texted us and she goes, so when can I come by and see the house? Never. that's a hard conversation to have. And so, you know, despite the fact that you have these boundary conversations with our neighbors when we moved them in, it is very difficult to keep having those relations or that conversation when you are living there with people, when they see your kids running through the hall, when they're taking care of your dog when you're at work, those sorts of things. There's all sorts of ethical ramifications there that I probably don't want to think about because I probably don't want to lose my license. But there, you know, lots of things about that. Boundaries, of course. You know, I hesitate to say this, but when I became a social worker, I never really envisioned a time where I would have a client in my bed, but it happened. Came home one night. Now, when I say my bed, I mean, I do literally mean my bed. But like our bed, when you open the door to this little room, our bed is right there. And so when people pass by, that's what they see. So I came home from work today, one day, and my wife is sitting talking about something that had happened with this client, and she's sitting Indian style on my bed, by my pillow. Never really thought that that would happen, but it did. You know, so definite constant conversations we have to have about boundaries, not only with the neighbors, but with me and my wife. Self-care was a nightmare. I tell my students all the time about self-care. Here's what you have to do. You have to have a plan. Not real good at it. You know, even when you have a plan, self-care is difficult when you're there 24 hours a day. You know, and so lots of knocks on the door at 1 and 2 a.m., sometimes important, sometimes not. But challenges to the shelter as a whole. Budget. Budget was a challenge. We go through a lot of food. When you have intentional community, you need a lot of groceries to foster that community. And we had a lot of debate about that. Most of our neighbors have food stamps. All of them qualify for food stamps. So we go back and forth whether we should provide groceries or whether we should require them to provide their own groceries. I mean, food stamp budget is a nightmare. We all know that, I think. So we go back and forth on whether or not we should use our limited resources to provide food in order to foster this community. You know, other things. We had to stop providing Ziploc bags because this group was extremely resourceful. And most of them smoked, which I know a lot of people have problems with. But I did have one of our neighbors say, you know what, I'm going to kick one addiction at a time here. He goes, let me worry about heroin now. Then I'll worry about smoking later. I mean, who's going to argue with that? And so most of them smoke. Well, cigarettes are expensive. So they all purchased a cigarette press, which is about this big. So they sit on the back porch and they press a month's worth of cigarettes at a time over about 3 or 4 hours. But they were using all the Ziploc bags for the loose tobacco. So we had to cut off the Ziploc supply because I can't in good conscience use money donated to produce cigarettes. But anyway, and so there's lots of different challenges here. But I do want to open it up. I would love our future. We can talk a little bit about that now. I want to make sure we have some time for questions, feedback, things like that. We've done a lot of things wrong over the last year. You know, we've had expectations that were not met, but also we have been overwhelmingly surprised by how positive this experience has been. People, you know, when we moved in, shame on me. I told my kids, I said, we're going to have stuff stolen from us. You know, we're gonna have things where people treat us in ways that shouldn't happen. We never had anything stolen from us. I left my apartment open all day once with my wallet on the counter right there for everybody to see. It didn't move. Security cameras also dissuade that, but still. You know, we had violence. We had domestic violence, things like that. Those are things that we expected, but also we didn't expect the close-knit community. We didn't expect how pretty much when you have expectations for people, they live up to those expectations. The Texas Homeless Network couldn't believe that there are times when the shelter is unstaffed. Like when we go to church on Sundays, there's no one there for 4 or 5 hours. You know, there were nights where we'd go out to dinner as a family where no one was there for 3 or 4 hours. It was fine. For the most part, it was fine. So I do think that one of the things that we didn't expect is people saw us not necessarily as the prison guards, but just as someone that was kind of living there to help them, like pass out toilet paper, things like that. And so there really wasn't that much of a difference from when we were gone to when we were there. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, How did the stupid, the stupid but obviously cute dog do?
He did great. That was, people were really sad when we left because of him. We did not expect that. And I did and do have significant guilt about kind of pulling that out from under them. We did the termination process as best we knew how. We gave it about a month out. We worked towards that. But people were very upset about the dog leaving. He's in training to be a therapy dog, and we thought that this would be a good test for him. It was. We had one lady who told us one day, she said, "You know, your dog's the only reason I get up every morning," which is devastatingly sad, but it's also encouraging. I mean, they loved that dog. I never feared leaving. Even when we would travel, we had other people come in and sub for us, but we'd leave the dog there because that community embraced him so much. So since we have left, they have bought another dog. We have gone from 90 pounds, I think, to 8 pounds. So I'm curious how that'll go. But he did really, really well. Now, you know, there are times where I'd go out and he had eaten a pack of Marlboros. Or I went out one time and his food dish was stained red. I'm like, what happened? Like, oh, we thought we'd give him some red Kool-Aid. I can't tell if he's happy or sad he's gone, because I don't give him red Kool-Aid. But anyway, go ahead.
I know you talked about, like, how boundaries were hard, but, like, what were some practical ways that you set up boundaries when
Yeah. Yeah. So, this worked some, and also, we had people coming in and out all the time, so the dynamics of the mix were constantly different. But we would, we had to be pretty specific early on about from 6 to 9 p.m. every night, that's our family time. That's when we're going to kind of shut our door and don't knock unless it's an emergency. People knocked all the time when it wasn't an emergency. But we just have to say, we'll deal with that later. We had to have talks, not talks, but when people would move in, we would basically kind of trying to outline the dynamics of our job. Don't call us. Well, I'm trying to think of a good example of that, because people called us all the time, too. We have silly things like we use a service where they don't have our cell phone numbers, and so it reroutes everything so we can decide to accept the call or not. We can decide whether to text them back or not, those sorts of things. And it was always evolving, trying to evolve, but that was one of the biggest challenges. Sure, honey.
Do you count these people as your clients or as co-residents in the facility?
Oh, that's a great question. The way I kind of...
That leads into the boundaries.
Absolutely, absolutely. All in all, I looked at them more as clients than not. Now, technically, I know we can't be technical. Technically, my wife was a part-time employee, and I was not an employee. I was a volunteer that lived there. So that's how I kind of separated it in my mind. I don't know if the state board would see that the same way. But I do look at them more as clients. When in doubt, kind of refer back to my training, and that's how we would deal with things. There were instances, though, where people would ask us if they could go to church with us. So sometimes we would load up the van and we would go to a church. Now, our church has an outreach program and a bar. They have church and a bar. It's called Bar Church. literally 2 blocks from this place. And so that was a perfect place to go. But some people are like, I don't want to go to Bar Church. I want to go to the real church. And so they would not even tell us, and they would show up at our church, and they're talking to us, and somebody introduces themselves like, oh yeah, we live at the Baldridges at Hope Haven. There's some major confidentiality things there that I don't know if I handled that right or not.
But it needs to be thought through.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of people in here are in those kinds of
absolutely
situations.
Yeah.
And if we're really going to enter into every man's world,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have to rethink that whole process.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we can't do it.
Yeah, you're right. The couple that took our place, she's not a social worker. I met her when she took my intro class like 5 years ago, though. But she's just got her degree in marriage and family therapy. And so they moved in. They don't have any kids, which I think will make it infinitely easier for them. But we were able to kind of talk them through about here's some things that we did that were wrong. And I think they are set up because we didn't know what we were getting into. I mean, we're creating this program on the fly. Now that it's pretty well established, I think they have some some more policies in place that would actually kind of delineate client, neighbor, that sort of stuff. But anyway, Andy, go ahead.
What was it like to do that with four kids and a set of twins?
It was rough. The kids did great. Rough in ways that I didn't expect. I expected to have a lot of hard conversations with the kids. And there was some of that, you know. Why is so-and-so out all night peeking through the fence? Well, it's because he's high on meth. But he's not violent. We had our code word, you know, where that means go to the apartment, shut and lock the door, and don't ask any questions. We never had to use it in a year. We never had to use it. The hard part was, though, our kids not being able to have their friends over to play, not being able to have sleepovers, having twins that you can't let out of your sight because they can't go and get into everything. So there's a lot of Netflix, which I don't think is a good parenting choice, but I did it a lot. so they're resilient. I'm hoping they bounce back. But that was the one of the hardest parts about it, is just logistically, it was really hard. Because whenever we had a new neighbor, we didn't know. And that's one of the things that I think was really difficult. Do I even want to say this? One of the things I told the students when I talked to them, I said, this is going to sound very preacher of me, forgive me, but I said one of the hardest things about following God and doing so is you can't have anything attached to it. And so for the first couple of months, we're like, all right, we'll do this as long as it doesn't hurt our family. We'll do this as long as, you know, it doesn't hurt our marriage. And we can't say that. You couldn't say that. You just have to do it or you don't do it. And so we said, you literally have to put your family in harm's way. I think I wrote this on the Shared Grace blog. You literally have to put your family in harm's way. I can't say it's going to be okay. There could be someone that hurts my kid. Because part of living in community means we're all down there watching movies together and doing stuff together. And the reality of that is that that might turn out not so good. And that was really hard. And so, I didn't get to spend as much time with my wife and my kids as I probably should. I wasn't the dad I probably should have been. And so we did this at the expense of that. I don't feel good about it. Like I said, I'm kind of a broken person after 3 weeks. But, you know, as it goes on, I'm sure I'll figure it out. I should probably get therapy. That's not sarcastic. I probably need to seek out some sort of, somewhere to hash out some of these issues. So, it was really difficult. But, again, I think my kids were richly blessed and transformed by this as well. Well, the girls, who knows what they know? They're young. But the older kids were able to see a population and see some people that were made in the image of God that they wouldn't usually get to see at their summer camps and in their, you know, whitewashed youth group events and stuff like that. So they did great. They were kind of the ones that kept us grounded a lot of the times, I think. And I think a lot of times when I talk about strengths-based with my students, I just rely on individual strengths. Of course, we should be talking about community strengths and strengths of a specific population. I think a good example of that is we have, I mean, with this population, there's lots of health issues. The average lifespan of a homeless person in Texas is 54. And so you see a lot of hospitalizations. And in the old model, you're not allowed to leave. And so if we would have kept that, we wouldn't have had what we had, which was when someone was hospitalized, two or three of the neighbors would move into the hospital with them. They were never there alone. like we would go up to visit and two or three of the neighbors that had already moved out were even up there. So they always kept in community and are kept in communication with each other. And I absolutely think that that's something that we accidentally found out for sure. Where we would invite everybody that had been there back in. There were talks about if that's, you know, confidentiality, because, you know, we're very protective of who gets in, obviously. But there were some things that we would do with groups that had already been there. That's about as far as we got along those lines. But I'd like to think of some more ways to do that, for sure. With the kids, we didn't have an overwhelming number of kids. Usually, always, we would have a couple. The most we ever had was, well, besides mine, were four or five at a time. And so we would just basically, and we did criminal background checks. And if there was, and we handled it on a case-by-case basis. So if there was something there that we thought would disqualify, that would provide a danger, then they would work hard to house them outside of the shelter. So we were pretty intentional about who got in as far as that goes. We really didn't have much issue. The biggest issue we actually had was a teenager that kept hitting his mom. But I'm not saying it's not ever going to be an issue, because like all things, it's not an issue until it is. So we'll see going forward how we're going to do that. The community as a whole, mixed reaction. Physically around the facility, it's not a residential area. It's in the middle of an industrial area. We're right next to a dog food plant. So it doesn't matter. No, half the people don't even know we're there. But the community as a whole, mixed reaction. One of the hardest things that I think we've had is we had a local foundation that we asked for a lot of money from. By and large, he was a fan of transitional housing. He does not like Housing First. And so we met with them. We kind of tried to soften him up over a year before we asked. We had our big ask, and we thought we had him there. We asked for $750,000, and he called us in, and he goes, "You guys are Pollyanna." He said, "You guys want to end homelessness?" He said, "Jesus says the poor will always be with us." He said, "Homeless people want to be homeless, from what I understand." I want to say, "Well, you don't understand it then." Because I got 375 people who don't want to be homeless on our waiting list. Didn't say that. I will say, even though he said that, he just gave us $250,000, which we asked for 750 and hoped for 200. So that's a win. But there is a lot of that. We had talked to people and they'd be like, "Well," somebody said, "I prefer to give my money to people who actually want to work." Like, well, most of our people are actually full-time employed, but so it's, you know, it's mixed reaction, like anything is with what we do. So, okay. Well, thank you, everybody. I know this is kind of a less traditional presentation, more of a storytelling. Send me an email or something if you have any other questions. I'd love to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.